Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Expanding Mind, exploring the cultures of consciousness. Now, I don't know what this says about me, but over the last few years, I've had not a small number of people that I know quite well, friends, go through a variety of rather intense psychological problems. Not just the sort of chronic problems of depression or anxiety and things like that, but acute crazy stuff. I'm just going to say that in a loose and general way because I still think it has a role to play in this discussion. And it's really a remarkable experience when you see people that you know go through these kinds of things. And one of the things that stuck with me that really made me realize is how much of our sense of reality, certainly like normal reality, well-functioning reality, it's not just based on ourselves or based on this physical world we have to navigate, but on the social reality we maintain with the people that we know and love, and particularly those that we love, but also ones we don't. And when somebody in that network goes into a deeply psychologically stressed space, you can feel the rupture. You can see the kind of almost like a violence done to the matrix of social reality. So it's not just, not only do you have the challenge of dealing with someone who's often very frightened, suffering, you can't tell whether they can make decisions or not. You're trying to talk to them like they have agency and maybe they don't have agency. And, you know, of course it changes in all these different situations. We'll go into details, but it's just the sense of proximity to not just an individual's own problem, but a social problem. Because, of course, the issue of madness, what's not madness, how do we deal with people who voluntarily and involuntarily sort of leave the conventional frame, those are social questions, and we handle them in our society in the very bad way that we do handle them in the society. And that's the other big thing you learn when you see people go through these kinds of extreme traumas and problems, is that the quote-unquote safety network is a very fragile thing indeed, for some good reasons and for some very bad reasons as well. So I've been thinking a lot about these issues lately, and so that's why I'm particularly happy today to invite Gregory Pleshaw onto our show. I'm used to referring to him as Gregory P. because that was the avatar he went by for many, many, many years, and we'll talk about why perhaps that avatar is no longer appropriate. But just to say a few words about him, I met him near 20 years ago now, or 15 plus, and I've seen him in a wide variety of psychological states, in all of which he has been a kind of wonderful, fascinating, lovable guy, even when he's been really extreme in his behavior. And I've seen him go through all sorts of experiences and changes. And as we'll talk about, one of the most interesting things about Gregory is he's incredibly articulate and has some perceptions and views on what he calls being crazy in America in ways that have really opened my eyes. But he's particularly interested in that fine line, which is so fine as to perhaps not really be existing, between what we think of as madness and what we think of as mysticism. So I think we're going to have some really really interesting discussion here today. But before that, I want to bring on our co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks. How are you?
Good. You sound nice and crisp today. That's a nice signal there. Yeah. We were just chatting online You've had the same kind of real first person or at least second person experience of having people with kind of severe psychological issues in your network, and what do you have to say about that?
Well, I have. My grandmother had mental issues, and of course, back in the day, they put you in a funny farm. So I know everyone says funny farm now, but people don't even know what that means anymore. But my grandmother was actually on a funny farm, and was treated with electroshock treatment and administered all kinds of drugs, and then took medication for the remainder of her life. And when she was not given her medication, it would kind of creep back in. And I have a very good friend who is schizophrenic. My first boyfriend had pretty severe mental issues where he would even black out and not remember his episodes, which would be so dramatic and, just off the hook that it was really gnarly for everyone around him to kind of go through. So I have experienced firsthand from kind of a variety, friends, lovers, family, all kinds of people that have dealt with these issues. So it takes up a pretty big part of my thoughts. And that's actually why I started studying psychology later in my life.
Well, one of the things about that that I think the third thing I really learned from all this is really just how prevalent these things are, not just in terms, yes, of the extreme experiences that some people go through, but the kind of, garden variety ills and plaints and paranoias and despairs and even schizophrenic episodes that many of us have in a variety of different ways throughout our lives. And yet there's just... Our culture does a very, very poor job of talking about it. Like you had mentioned on our chat, like on the one hand, we're incredibly medicated with, so many people are on these psychotropic mood stabilizers, et cetera, and yet we don't really have a way of kind of talking about our own madness or what to do about it when these things happen to people that we know and love. So it's really an urgent issue right now. And I was pleased to hear that Friday Gary Null will be doing a show and talking about some of these issues as well. But now I'd like to bring on the wonderful Gregory Pleshoff. How you doing, Gregory?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
And where are you calling from?
I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm balancing a teacup on the end of my nose.
Well, that's great, man. I always associate you with New Mexico. I think that was, did we meet there or did we meet at SIGGRAPH? I can't remember.
I think we met at SIGGRAPH 1995.
Yeah, in Los Angeles.
I think that's where we met. Yeah,
so let's just start there. I'd love to get a sketch out a little bit of this. I know we're going to get to some big issues later, but I'd really love to hear a little bit about your own kind of history with these experiences. Like when I met you in 1995, where were you in your head, in your world?
Well, I was post my first psychotic break, and my first psychotic break came in the spring of 1994. And I had I didn't know what it was at all. I until later. It was, I was in San Francisco, of course. This is where such things happen. And I was working on my senior thesis at New College of California. And I've since then spoken with a number of people who are now labeled bipolar and take the proper bipolar medication for whom the first psychotic break seems to have come during, say, a senior thesis in college or during a doctoral dissertation, where there's an incredible amount of intellectual stress going on, and combined with maybe a strange environment. I hadn't been in San Francisco in about 3 years at that point, and everything was very vivid. My degree is in creative writing, so I was working on some kind of crazy experimental novel at the time, and it got crazier and crazier and crazier. It was there were all kinds of not every, but many things that I saw took on major nuances and inner meanings that seemed very similar in on reflection to a psychedelic experience, but it went on for months and months and months. It was 3 or 4 months of just like complete the interconnectedness of all things, and dreams that were really not necessarily disturbing, but fit in with my day-to-day life. So I would wake up and I would have had a dream about what had happened the day before, and I would write that down, and I had this overwhelming sense that whatever I was writing was relational synchronistically to what was going to happen next. And it wasn't a benign sensibility. It was like this sort of, it got to the point where I felt like my pens were imbued with some sort of magical abilities. And at some point I was instructed by an old shamanistic looking person on the streets of Haight-Ashbury to go dip my pens into the sea, because the salt water would eliminate all of this magical effluvia that I thought was coming out of my pens. It was a very strange time, and what ended up happening was is that I went back to my home state of New Mexico. I graduated, and I went back to my home state of New Mexico, and I presented myself on the couch of a psychiatrist, and I said I saw this magical world, and it was just incredible, and now it's gone. And he said, well, that's magical thinking, and magical thinking is a symptom of bipolar disorder, and here, take these meds.
What did that do to your meaning? I mean, like, how did you tell yourself a story about what had happened to you when you came out of that state? Like, I remember talking to you once, you know, many years ago, where you were sort of saying that even though you recognized that it was a peculiar and in some ways disturbing place, there was also an incredible excitement and vividness
and sense of meaning.
So how did you tell a story about it afterwards?
Well, that's the thing, was that I felt very stuck. I believed him because I began to read texts. I read K. Redfield Jemison's books on, you know, Touched by Fire and The Unquiet Mind. And I got a sense that, like, there were people in history, like Shelley and Byron and people like that, who had also experienced similar things. But that first time, I couldn't let go of what I had experienced. I couldn't. I took the Depakote. I believe at that time I was on Depakote, and I took it, and my mood stabilized. I mean, again, some of this is hindsight, because it's taken 15 or 20 years to figure out how all this stuff works. But I still maintain that there was something very magical that happened in there. So the way I look at it now is that it's both, you know, it's both a mystical sort of initiation type thing, and it's also relational to, you know, a psychiatric disorder and a psychiatric diagnosis.
Well, and I think that's like a really big issue with, like how Eric was saying, there's a fine line, because honestly, the majority of schizophrenic and even bipolar episodes, they read like a mystic experience. And even the
right.
fact that they diagnose it saying that's magical language, well, what is, I mean, that
right.
means you're thinking magically, which is, yes,
right.
normal people think that's crazy, but that's like where God time kind of comes in, you know? I mean, did you have in that experience like feelings of God at all, or was it more?
Oh, absolutely.
Kind of, right.
I didn't identify with a Godhead at that point, but my sense was, I'd grown up in a New Age community, so I had this sense of being in touch maybe with the goddess, you know, that maybe I was, you know, tarot cards took on exponential meaning, you know, feathers in the street became like this metaphor for me whenever, you know, you'd see a pigeon feather in the street, and I was convinced that it was a sign that God was nearby. I can't remember where that particular thing came to pass that I made that association, but to this day, if I see a feather in the street, I think it means that God is.
Well, that's
is
what
near
shamans
me.
Say. Like Native Americans say, when you come into contact with birds, that literally means like presence of God. So, I mean, that's a
right.
traditional omen, you know.
So, So taking these ideas, like we'll go deeper in them, but just to stay with this period in time, what did as you took the DEPA code, as you got you absorbed this diagnosis, you started to read more and go, oh my gosh, this is so like recognizable. How did your own sense of the meaningfulness of the experience that you had just gone through change?
Well, it didn't. It led me to a lot of despair, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, it was like what I had experienced was so, I hate to use the word pure, but it was pure. It felt really like me and really like, you know, it was, I guess the best way to put that was, you know, I mean, I was, you know, I'm a writer and a reader, you know, and I had read all kinds of mythology and all kinds of, you know, mystical books and all kinds of, you know, again, like coming up in a New Age community, read all kinds of, you know, I don't know, New Agey stuff and 2012 related things and the Mayan factor and things like that. And I felt so imbued with this sense of the kinds of consciousness that people are talking about in terms of like relational to like the human potential movement and things like that. I mean, I felt really sort of, I don't know, Eslined by the whole experience on some level, that there was something going on. And yet, psychiatry was the best way to put it is that the only shaman to whom to turn to in our culture that is credible or that we deem as credible is the psychiatrist's couch. And I, you know, my parents were reasonably flipped out when I returned sort of from school. I had gone to school being a sort of semi, you know, responsible young 23 or 24 year old and returned with like this blazing crazy mohawk with all kinds of weird shit strung into my hair. This was the early 90s. I think people did stuff like that. And I was talking about these magical experiences, and they were concerned because, you know, it seemed like I was getting off track from what I'd been doing. And to me, it was part, you know, it was a bigger track than what I'd been doing. It was so much more interesting than, you know, I mean, at the time I was 23 or 24 years old writing about bands and pop culture and things like that. And this seemed so much more, you know, in keeping with like a, you know, that there was a sense of destiny to it. And a lot of that destiny was kind of tied up with having grown up in 2012 culture. I mean, it's, you know, that we did the harmonic convergence here in 1987 and we did all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I had this very strong sense that we were in the last 25 year cycle of, you know, whatever. I still, it's been 25 years and I still don't fully understand the long count and all that stuff, but there was a sense that this was a quickening, that this experience that I was having was sort of like a had the potential to thrust me into some sort of role in that particular drama. But at the end of it, I was sort of left with, you know, this sense of despair because, one, when I started taking the medication, it was over. You know, I mean, when you begin to mood stabilize, these things cease to occur to you. You may have glimmers. You know, you may see a tarot card, a favorite tarot card that under the right set of circumstances, the Seven of Cups may mean a lot to you. You know, if you're off medication, you might see that and think, oh, life is full of rich bounty. And then you see it when you're off medication, you're like, yeah, when I was crazy, I kind of thought that meant a lot, but right now it doesn't mean very much because I mean, it's not just a question of like interpretation. It's a question of like, I mean, there's not just intellectual feelings to this. There are body sensations. Mm-hmm. There is a sense of, you know, in the right set of circumstances, there's a sense of like gossamer thread coming out of your fingertips that you are in touch with something that's much, much larger than yourself. And that the cues that we use, you know, tarot cards or crystals or whatever are enhanced with so much more meaning.
That element of meaningfulness is really fascinating because on the one hand, it's what we're, you know, like if you just sort of ask, well, what do you want? Well, I want a meaningful life. You know, you want something meaningful. And if you look at precisely tarot, crystals, New Age, and then conventional religion, people who turn towards, you know, especially to going to classic, you know, going back to the, you know, Eastern Orthodox Church because they feel the sense of mystery and the sense of meaningfulness. And then you, if you start getting a little bit of that, hey, that's pretty great. Like, I had a synchronicity the other day. I don't know what it meant, but it, that little juice, that little extra kind of, you know, fairy jump in my step as I walk down the street because there's something there.
Right.
But you just turn up the volume and things get really out of hand. And it's the same volume. You know, it's the same signal. It's just that the volume.
Same signal. It's just much louder.
So then you have this despair. And then I know at a certain point you started to really think about what it meant to go off the meds again. Like, what does that mean to be on them? And what does it mean to be off? And how did you do that?
There have been three major periods when I was off medication. One was the first time before I knew that I needed medication, and what I've been able to suss out at this point is that I probably had a mood disorder, which is the best way to put it, beginning around the age of 15. It seems like that's when things started to go kind of nutty for me, and I would go up and down, and, you know, my parents thought it was adolescence, and I went to some child psychologists and things like that, but nothing really stuck. But, you know, this particular incident sort of nailed it, and the psychiatrist that my parents took me to when I was 24, you know, was sort of this, you know, he's from UCLA, and he'd seen lots and lots of cases. He was known as the sort of the best person in town for psychopharmacology, you know, so I ended up in his couch. And so there were three periods when I was off. One was prior to ever getting medicated. The other was in my late 20s, my early 30s, when I it was 9/11, I had a vision to go off medication, as I do. I have these visions that say, you know, it's time to put this behind. I sold everything I owned, and I bought a van, and I moved to Seattle to be a homeless activist. And that was when Wish Paper happened. Wish Paper was a project that I did where I encouraged people to make wishes based on a paper that I made for them. And, you know, so the magical thinking kicked into play, and the nice thing about when the magical thinking kicks into play and it's good, the creativity is astounding. And I mean, you know, that's one of the things that's hardest to let go about going back on the medications, is that the level of creativity that I have at my disposal, even in the weirdest situations. I mean, I was living in squats and, like, you know, eating out of food banks and things like that, but I didn't, you know, it didn't deter me from the various projects that I had going on.
Well, that's very important, I think, and I want to just, like, harp on that for a moment. And like you said, you know, the creativity and the amount of artists, like you were talking about Lord Byron and, you know, people like this. I mean, my friend who was diagnosed schizophrenic, he is an unbelievable artist. And, I mean, the things that come out of him, no person could conceive of inside of their brain.
Right.
So the creativity is no small matter that is involved in these kind of things. It's actually, like, upon epic breakthroughs in humanity. I mean, I know that might sound like magical thinking to a psychologist, it's true. Like, you see the artistic breakthroughs that happen in these instances, and they're heavy duty.
Well, and I agree with you, but the flip side, unfortunately, I mean, if it were only just creativity that was, you know, a symptom of being off medication, I would do it all the time. The issue is that what I have discovered about it, and it's taken time to figure out, you know, why one should be on one's meds. I mean, I could change 10 years from now. I seem to have these 10-year cycles where I decide that it's time to be off med again. But basically, you know, the way it affects your relationships with others is really, that's the tough part. And, you know, I can't stress that enough. I mean, if I had, you know, if I'm ever asked to speak at a bipolar convention and they say, why do you take your meds? It would be, you know, primarily it's not for me, it's for the people in my life.
Mm.
Because, you're so out there. When this last occasion when I went off med, the amount of creativity that was generated in my brain was so astonishing. I mean, I felt like, and I certainly was, I was tracking all kinds of different data sets, you know, reading the news and, you know, absorbing things about global currencies. And, I mean, I had all kinds of weird theories going on, not necessarily conspiratorial, but things that to me seemed fairly lucid analysis of what was going on globally in terms of the economy, politically, things like that. I got very interested in all kinds of things that, as a general rule, I just don't have time for, because when you're off medication, I mean, my experience when I'm off medication, normal goals, normal, you know, sort of work a day, I'm going to do this job and pay this rent and all that stuff goes out the window. You don't care about any of that stuff. Mm. All that stuff becomes just, who cares? You know, I'll live in a tent. I've lived in a car. I mean, I've lived in all kinds of like weird and marginal situations in order to accomplish whatever, you know, whatever weird creative goals I've got at any given moment when I'm not medicated. And without blinking an eye. I mean, I look back on certain periods of my life, particularly like Seattle, San Francisco, early 2000s. I mean, I was like, you know, I would have lived anywhere to accomplish my weird little projects. And, you know, I'm not much of a visual artist, so I can't show you like 10 canvases that are really spectacular. I just write these weird things, you know. I write weird things with.
Well, I gotta say, you're right. You're an excellent writer, and I've, you know, I've always been encouraging you to hopefully, you know, and I know you have different reasons, hot and cold on the project of writing about, you know, being crazy in America, because one of the other dimensions of this is that even as you're wrestling with these, you know, really meaningful questions in psychology and even the question of mysticism and how do these things relate, you've also, you know, have this sort of, I don't know, privilege isn't quite the right word, but you've been able to observe how the system works from the inside, right, from a place of marginality, because unlike a lot of, you know, middle class people who go through these situations, you were also like this freak who like let yourself live, yeah, and survive in these various margins, and therefore your relationship with the social system and the health system and the medical system came more from a place of marginality rather than from a kind, right, of more place of middle class privilege. So this has given you a, right, very interesting look at the political reality of being crazy in America. So, you know, well, what did you find?
Just to touch on that, there's a book that I put out based on my writings of the early 2000s. It's called The Collapse of Time, Confessions of a Quantum Humanist. You can find it on Amazon. For my birthday this year, I made it into an ebook. I made it as a paperback originally, and once I went back on medication, but you know, there's an essay in there called The Waiting Room. And The Waiting Room is about being at the Free Mental Health Clinic at the corner of Turk and Goff in San Francisco. And, you know, that is a place where, you know, I mean, you know, it's a good place to go spend an afternoon, you know, take a book, sign in, see how long it takes you to actually get seen. It takes about 8 hours. But it's a, you know, it's a real indictment of our current healthcare system, because a lot of the people, you know, a lot of the people that we're going to see on the streets, homeless, et cetera, are going to be people who are undiagnosed or, if diagnosed, under-medicated, who may have a shot at doing something other than, you know, being crackheads on 16th and Valencia, if they had adequate health care. But of course we don't believe in that for some odd reason in this country. And it's, you know, it's watching all of that and being a participant in that system, mostly out of need. I mean, there are times when I think, you know, I have been mood stabilized in the past, and there's all kinds of ways that you could, you know, like I've been on Medicaid since 2003, and I finally did that. I went to Turk and Goff and to get a refill of something, and a social worker pulled me into her office and sat me down in a chair and brought out this enormous phone book size file, and she dropped it on her desk, and she said, "Mr. Plushaw, do you know what this is?" And I said, "No, I don't." And she said, "It's your case file." And, you know, I had, at that point, I remember having had no memory of having been in Turkengolf, but I had actually been there, you know, a dozen times, and they had paperwork on me from New York, Rhode Island, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, you know, I mean, like various places where I'd had some kind of, you know, manic offense and ended up in some emergency room somewhere. And this woman said to me, she said, "Why aren't you on SSI?" And I said, "Well, I don't qualify." And she said, "What makes you think you don't qualify?" I said, "Well, I'm white, I'm middle class, I have a college degree." I mean, like, you know, that's for poor people. She's like, "You're crazy." you know, and I mean, but I'd been putting it together in this piecemeal sort of fashion as I traveled the country. You know, I would just kind of, you know, people talk, other crazies meet other crazies, and you find out where the free meds are, and you find out who's got, you know, this and that going on and this and that program. Because there are, I mean, one thing I can say about America is that it is a crazy patchwork quilt out there of free mental health services, but they do exist. I mean, they exist. Almost every community I've ever found myself in, and I'm large and small, from Point Arena, California to, you know, San Francisco or Los Angeles, I mean, there are places that exist that deal with people like me who are uninsured, underemployed, you know, and markedly crazy. You know, they will deal with you. And the advantages that I've always had, crazy or not, is that I'm white, I'm male, I'm middle class, and I'm articulate. So I can walk into one of these situations, and even off my nut, I can say, you know, "In 1994, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Here are the medications that I've taken, blah, 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 blah." You know, I can go through that whole thing, you know, with my eyes closed, literally. And, you know, and pretty much walk out of any situation like that with whatever meds I need to get stabilized again. But it is a patchwork quilt to do it that way, and not many people, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I think I do it for sport, honestly, but
well, this is a wonderful conversation, Gregor, but we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Gregory Plushaw. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis and Gregory Plushaw. We're talking a little crazy talk, getting a little crazy. Gregory, before the break and earlier, you had talked about, you know, how you think the most important thing to take meds is that you can have relationships with other people. And it was interesting because you mentioned how the crazy people all get together and talk about where the free meds are and kind of form their own communities. And I wanted to just kind of talk about how it is taboo to talk about mental illness amongst people, even your friends or loved ones. And I'm certainly not judging the need for medication, as you said, to interact in society, but it is kind of this thing where it's not acceptable to be crazy, so you have to change to be more normal. And normal people will not interact with crazy people until they do become more normal. And it goes, I think, along with the mystic experience stuff you were talking about, because that shaman who has those mystic experiences, where does he live in Native cultures? He lives on the outside. He's
on the outskirts.
An outsider,
yeah.
Right? He does not live in the village with everyone else, although they'll certainly go see him when they have a problem and they need healing, but he is ostracized. And it's, to me, it seems very similar that unless you don't integrate, that you're kicked to the curb, you're the homeless, you're the outsider. And I was just wondering, have you, you know, faced stigma or, like, I know you said...
Marginalization?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so, but I mean... I think that I want to clarify that, you know, when I say that I do it for my relationships, I mean, it's not wholly selfless to say so. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that I think that's really important about mystical and or crazy experience of, you know, either one is that if you have one, part of the goal, or part of what is your due, the challenge that you have to meet at that point is to reintegrate yourself into the society. And that's not always the case with Native American shamans, but one of the things that I've read about the latest sort of weird mystical experience that I had was that once you have it, you know, you kind of have to, you know, figure out, you know, once you've had the great dance with the divine and all of that, you have to sort of find yourself a role within the society again and sort of not necessarily forget about what happened, but integrate it into your modus operandi in terms of how you're going to deal with the rest of the culture. And I think that that's a kind of a key challenge for those of us who have these kinds of strange experiences, is it's not enough to have them. And then, you know, there's a guy here in Santa Fe, I've not met him, but he's called the Bad Shaman, and he lives on some, you know, in some strange place or whatever. And as it turns out, the Bad Shaman, who's a real person from what I understand, I have not met him, but the Bad Shaman recently discovered he has a thyroid condition. And a thyroid condition will make you quite crazy. And what he's now taking thyroid medication, this Bad Shaman, and he's not so bad. And, you know, part of the deal is I think that we can have mystical insight and mystical experience, but I think we can also bring it back down to brass tacks. I mean, I used to think, the first couple of times around, I really thought that I'd gotten the short end of the stick, you know, in terms of, well, I had this really, you know, kooky experience that I loved a lot, and now I have to take these meds and, you know, forget that it happened. Now I think that I'm sort of lucky because I have the best of both worlds. I mean, it's certainly at this point in time, you know, with the kinds of mood stabilizers available and things like that, I mean, you can go nuts for a period of a year and a half, which is what I did recently, and then sort of, you know, find your way into a psychiatrist's office. It's not as easy as it sounds. It took months to actually figure out which med combo would sort of stabilize me again. But, and then not have quite the same severity of cycle, and then sort of harness the power of what you've experienced and hopefully use it, you know, to bring greater good to humanity, or at least keep your shit together. Excuse me, I'm on the radio. But you know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, I think
well,
that, like,
it's
the
true.
Marginalization,
I mean, no,
aspect.
It's totally true. Even the shaman has to interact with people. I mean, right?
Right.
So you do. You have to find that way to integrate it. I think that's totally true.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I really appreciated about our friendship is because I just sort of made a, you know, like once I was like, okay, this guy's my pal, I'm going to stick with him, you know, thick and thin.
Thanks,
is that I respected your decision to go off meds sometimes, so that I sort of be kind of signed up to deal with you however you came at me. And
right.
Sometimes it was very hard. Sometimes I was very worried about you. Sometimes it got tedious. Sometimes it was incredibly inspiring. But
right.
It's interesting, too, how that journey that you're going on is also a journey that the people around you are going on.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, as you're well aware, and so is anyone else who is fortunate or unfortunate enough to have their email address in my Gmail, you know, I write these epic letters when I'm off medication, and, you know, I mean, I look in my outbox. I've since had the chance to look in my outbox since I got back on medication, and some of the things I've said are just like, wow, I was really out of my mind, but some of the things I said are like, I look at them and they're just these incredible documents of, like, you know, this kind of manic, crazy mind at work, trying to parse through a variety of different issues and look at a lot of different stuff. Because I think one of the issues that I think is that, you know, they also talk about the fine line between madness and genius, and I would never claim to be of the latter. But I think that one of the things that happens in a hyper-stimulated society such as ours is that we take on an enormous amount of data on a regular basis, not just normal stuff like getting up and going to work and all that kind of stuff, but I mean, the dizzying complexity of the modern society has it that we take in an enormous amount of information that we never use, because it's not useful to us in states of normalcy, right? There's just a big kind of, you know, those little blips on the screen of like, you know, the Dow Jones is up 45% and the this, that, and blah, 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 and all this stuff is going on. And we never have the ability to sit down and make any connections about what all that weird data means. Then you go off medication and, you know, and you give yourself a break from consensus reality. And my mind, anyway, when I'm off medication, my mind moves at this rapid fire pace to try and connect all that data. Whether it's connecting that data properly or not is difficult for me to say. But the fact that I get a glimpse of a mind at work that's trying to make sense of all this disparate data. And that, I mean, that alone is like, God, throw the pills in the ocean, forget it, put me on a cruise ship with a live connection to the internet. Because you get this opportunity to sort of pull things together and sort of, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like when I'm off medication that I construct incredible sort of word poetry that, you know, unfortunately never really sees the light of day unless you get one of my emails. you know, email is like the worst thing invented for a manic depressive person, I think.
Interesting, because you're almost put in a position where you're able to psychoanalyze your episodes. When you get back on medication, you have this, like, record of the experience. Because, like you said, you don't remember it and you don't recall. So it's almost like you get access to your subconscious through those emails.
Well, it's interesting because what happened is that initially I had a public blog. Someone gave me a blog for Christmas called strident.org about 5 years ago, 3 years ago. And that was public. And I was traveling around and I was making this stuff public. And at one point, early on when I first went off medication, I was convinced that the CIA was following me. And I know that sounds like a classic paranoid gesture. But given where I was, which was Southeast Asia, right before the revolution, I didn't think they were following me. I actually thought that someone had appeared to debrief me because I was involved. I was writing a bunch of stuff about what was going on with the revolution in Thailand, and it was all public. And I didn't know lots of things about the issue of freedom of the press in Southeast Asia, which is different from America. And someone sort of appeared in my life out of nowhere and proceeded to debrief me about, I mean, you know, it was a debriefing, whether he was CIA or not, I don't know, but basically proceeded to debrief me about, you know, you can get in trouble for writing about these types of things, was basically what I was told. So I shut down my blog and made it private. And then I began to, every time I wrote something that seemed significant, I would CC it to my blog. So I do have this enormous archive of, like, all the weird shit I was thinking about at any given point. And that was for the I'm going off med and going to Southeast Asia tour.
Let me just say that I got not only emails from Gregory during this period, but also some wonderful Skype calls. So I'd be sitting there, like, getting up in the morning, and I'd get this Skype call. And there's Gregory with his bald head and this single, you know, cheap light bulb hanging, and he had this, you know, this kind of look, and it was a little bit like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, except not like
totally.
More like hyper and kind of like a giddy, and it was, you know, kind of remarkable. But the reason I bring up that whole Thailand episode is that even though you look at that period and you say, oh, I was kind of, you know, crazy or, you know, totally wild. You had some experiences there, particularly through the Tibetan Buddhist practices that you were doing, that were extraordinarily powerful. That now, today, you'll still say, you know, I know I was crazy, I know I was off meds, but that stuff was something else. And I only about like 10, 12 minutes left. I'd love to hear a little bit about that experience and how it is that you think about that relationship, these manic episodes, to whatever you want to call it, authentic spirituality or a different kind of experience.
Well, Let me know if my sound's coming in okay, because you're coming in a little choppy. Am I okay?
You're fine.
Okay, good. So basically, I went to India. The whole deal with going off medication, I had a vision at Burning Man, right? Classic. I had a vision at Burning Man to go off medication. The reason for that was I was sick and tired of being sick. Because there's something about, you know, at that point I was taking 7 pills a day. I was taking lithium, Lexapro, Abilify, and Lamictal. And so that was, 3 hits of lithium, Lexapro, and Abilify, and Lamictal. So it was 6 pills a day. So basically there's this ritual. You open the bottles, you take the pills, there's this whole thing of and with each pill it's sort of I'm sick, I'm sick, I'm sick, I'm sick. And I had gone long enough feeling what is this good for anyway? So this keeps me stabilized for what? I felt like my life sucked, and I felt like it didn't have any meaning in it. I had sort of, as I always have, was eking out a small living, writing, not total garbage, but basically writing arts copy for the New Mexican and places here in Santa Fe. And I, my life just felt flat and boring, so... And I was tired of reinforcing the notion that I was sick. So I went off medication, and I decided that I had this vision that I should take charge of my own wellness by learning yoga and meditation and seeing if yoga and meditation could somehow help me maintain the craziness. It seems to me now a hopelessly naive agenda, but at the time it just seemed like, why don't I try this? So... had a vision on a yoga mat, had this idea, did it, whatever. Ended up going to India, flew to Dharamsala, and flew to Delhi and took a train to Dharamsala, and in the meantime having, interesting sort of word visions all over the place, great dreams, fantastic stuff. Ended up in Dharamsala, and while I was there, I'd learned what I believe, someone can correct me out there if I'm wrong, is some kind of old school tantric meditation thing, and it's called Vajrasattva Four Opponent Powers. And I learned this in a meditation center in Dharamsala, a relative stone's throw from the Dalai Lama's residence. So I learned this thing and I began to practice it, and what I felt like was the more I practiced it, the more patient I became, the less irritable I became, the less agitated I became. And these things are no small accomplishments in India, because India is irritable, makes you impatient. I mean, it's a nut house, basically. It's a great place for a crazy person to be, wandering around to the Himalayas, marrying myself in a wooded grove, naked. Anyway, whatever. I had a field day in India. India was fantastic for me. But basically... the more I did this meditation, the more I felt like something was happening. And at the time, I was studying neuroplasticity, which is Richard Davis's. He's from the University of Wisconsin. And he's been studying how advanced meditators may have the ability to change the structure of their brains and be more loving and be more compassionate and be more patient and be all the wonderful things we'd like to be less angry. And so... I was studying all of that, and I was thinking, maybe this thing works. Maybe I've got more, maybe there's more to this stuff than I think, because I really felt this marked increase of patience, sense of compassion, a sense of selflessness, selflessness, and it was really incredible. And from there, I flew back to Thailand, and I did this thing for another couple of weeks, and I went astral. And this experience was wackadoodle. I was awake for 9 days. I was on a beach. I saw, visions of Dakinis dancing in front of me. Everything about the experience was imbued with a sense of everything I had just studied about Buddhism.
Wow.
I saw, it was just outstanding. At one point I was sitting, I was walking down the beach and I collapsed neatly into a full lotus on the beach as the sun was setting. The clouds were pink and there was this force trying to pull me into the clouds and saying, if you just let go, you can leave samsara. And I was all for it because the pink clouds were like enveloping me with the most outstanding feeling of love and compassion that anyone could ever hope or expect to feel in their lives. I couldn't let go for reasons I discovered later, that I basically had attachments in samsara and I had to stay. But I ended up at one point by the fourth or fifth day thinking that, you know, I need a teacher. Someone needs to tell me how to get out of this. And I had this vision that I could split my brain in two and allow one side to mentor the other side. And as soon as I thought it, it happened. I felt my brain separating into two halves and one side of my brain beginning to talk to the other side of my brain. And these were visceral physical sensations. And I can't even begin to stress like how outstanding the experience was. It was terrifying though. It was both things. It was extraordinary and it was terrifying. I saw, you know, the hairs on the backs of butterflies' wings. I could stare at waves and then blink and make the wave kind of stop in midair. It was just, you know, all of these really out there type of experiences. Yeah, there was this dog that followed me around the beach that seemed like he had been my dog for centuries. I mean, it was like really out there. And at one point, I had this feeling of my chakras opening, and I figured out a way to open and close them by rolling my pupils back and forth. It was, you know, it was really out there. But one of the things that by the fourth or fifth day, and I was taking Seroquel trying to get to sleep, and it didn't happen. But by the fourth or fifth day, it began to occur to me that this was a mystical experience, certainly, but that it was neurological.
Mm.
Like I got a very strong sense that whatever was going on with me was a neurological situation, and that there was something going on in my brain. Like it was not external to me at all. These visions I was seeing were not external, but they came out of my head. And that seems a fait accompli to some degree. But really, when you think about it in terms of neurology, then it takes on this whole other level where it's just like, okay, I'm having a mystical experience and seeing all of these things, but I'm also, this has to be related somehow to my neurology. And it took me some time of research to figure out that there's a whole group of people who are studying this very thing, the fine line between neurology and mysticism, and they're called the neurotheologists. And I'm sure that they're reductionists. I'm sure that, you know, I haven't read their primary texts. I've only read about them on Wikipedia and other various places on the web. But I'm sure that they're maybe they're a real reductionist crew of scientists who are sitting around going, well, all those weird experiences that people have, you know, that's just stuff in their brain. You know, I would bet that they're like that. But on the other hand, someone is looking into this stuff. Now, this is interesting because it relates to something called latent inhibition. And latent inhibition is a really interesting thing that has been fairly recently discovered in neurology. But it's this idea that latent inhibition is like a well of chemistry. You know, it's like a big pile of schlucy chemicals in your head. And when the well is lowered, you get increased levels of creativity. And when you lower it even further, you get bipolar disorder. And when you lower it even further, you get schizophrenia. Now, researchers have shown, based on the research that I've picked up on the Internet, which, you know, that could be true or false, basically that not only does latent inhibition get lowered in these various types of diagnoses, but latent inhibition also gets lowered through the use of cannabis and through the use of psychedelics.
Hmm.
So my theory at this point is that there is a relationship between mysticism, mental illness, creativity, and that all of these things are basically drawing their power from the same source in our head somewhere. That neurology has some, you know, I mean, obviously neurology has a part to play in mental illness, but that, like, the use of psychedelics, creativity, mental illness, and neurology are all kind of tied together in such a way that they sort of feed on one another.
Wow, Gregory, that's great stuff. But we got to close up here.
on Expanding Minds. So I just want to thank you for being on the show and talking to us about all this stuff. And is there any place you could point anyone to read your stuff?
Again, if anyone wants to read The Collapse of Time, Confessions of the Quantum Humanist, that is available on Amazon. I don't have the URL, sorry. But it's Gregory Pleshaw, and I think it's $5.23, because 5 is the law of 5s, and 23 is 23.
All righty. Well, thanks a lot, Greg. See you later.
Good thing. Okay, catch you later. Bye.
From me and Maja here on Expanding Mind, keep your minds open.